Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Coaching Podcast from British Canoeing Awarding Body.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the British Canoeing Awarding Body Coaching Podcast. My name is Lee Pooley. I'm the Director of Coaching and Qualifications, and today we are joined by two people. So today we're joined by Ivan and we're joined by Scott. Hi, both.
Hi, I'm Lee.
So before we dig into the particular subject, which is about wash hanging, and we're going to explore what on earth that means, but I think what would be good is if for the listeners, if you could give a little bit of a background on who you are and your knowledge on this particular area. So Ivan, are you all right to go first?
Yep, good. I've been a flat water racer and a flat water coach for as long as I can remember, with which my short-term memory, that could be only 3 minutes or it could be 30 years. In my canoeing career, I guess I made a living wash hanging. That's what I did. Yeah, it's one tool in your box and it was my specialist tool. So yeah, I used it as a way of getting more out of my ability than my ability actually itself allowed.
Brilliant, thank you. Scott?
I'm going to echo that. I'm a flat water racer and coach. And I would say I had a similar skill set to Ivan. I just wasn't as gifted as him physically and mentally. So I used wash hanging to outperform my ability as well. So look after yourself in big groups, whereas your physical capacity didn't necessarily enable you to do that.
So, you're almost, it's quite intriguing, just listening to you. You're not giving it away, but you're almost teasing the listeners about, well, what on earth is wash hanging? So, Ivan, if I come to you, what is wash hanging? And, a little bit more about the context of why you used it. It's not cheating, is it?
No, absolutely, it's not cheating. I mean, you'd be a fool to think of it as cheating. So it's really basic. As a boat goes through water, the energy of that boat going through the water creates waves. Every wave has a downhill side and an uphill side. And if you position your boat on the downhill side of that wave, you are literally going downhill. So just like on a bike, if you're going downhill, it's a hell of a lot easier than going uphill. And you gain an advantage from going down that hill. All you have to do is understand where the hill is, how to sit on it, and when to sit on it. It's a very basic concept.
With that basic concept, do we know what sort of, does it give you a 10%?
Yeah.
What sort of...
So roughly, it gives you 3 seconds a minute. So if I'm working at 100% on my own, I'll do a minute and three seconds, if you like, whereas I could sit exactly that same comfort level someone who covers that same distance in 1 minute. So over 1,000 meters, it's worth 12 seconds to me.
Okay. I'm just trying to get sort of everyone's head around this in terms of marathon. We know that marathon happens on quite, it can happen in quite flat water environments, but also you can get some chops, side winds, you can get all sorts. Is wash hanging something that could be used in quite a lot of different environments?
The whole of surf ski works on wash hanging. It's just that the waves aren't created by another canoe. Mm-hmm. They're created by the wind. Waves are wave. Mm-hmm. The surf ski guys are probably the best at using them. We're probably second best. And then it filters down through other disciplines from there.
Brilliant. Okay. So this is all around, the technical and tactical aspects of wash hanging, isn't it? And this is what we're here to talk about today. And to highly experienced coaches of marathon and other aspects of paddle sports, what would be your approaches to introduce wash hanging to someone that's new to it? So, they can forward paddle, but actually you're introducing wash hanging as a concept. What, for both of you, maybe Scott, you go first, what would your approaches be?
Firstly, I'd do it in the warm. Because chances are they might take a swim at some point. The easiest way to start is nose to tail. So in beginnery type boats, they have a lot of buoyancy in them. And usually there's children. So they're quite light for the boats. So they don't kick off a huge amount of wave. And therefore they don't feel it either. So if you stick your nose on their tail, it's the easiest wash to feel. And it's the easiest wash to steer around. So we do nose to tail, and you can just feel the boat pulling you along. boat in front. If you're lucky enough and you live on a big enough river, you can do the same with cruisers and pleasure boats, and that's really entertaining. You know, you can go along on the back of those for very little effort and feel how the wave pushes you around and such like. So how you steer constantly against the wave, but not so much as you veer off away from it, so on. So that's where I'd start on the simple, just on the tail. And when you talk about feedback loops, if it's easy, you're in the right place. If it's hard, you're in the wrong place. And you just move your boat forwards and backwards to where you feel it's the easiest. If it's too hard, you're probably too close and climbing up out of the hole that's being created by the boat in front.
You use the word feel quite a lot within most of your descriptions. When it goes well, what are people feeling? Is it, you know, because when I surf on the sea, I feel a surge. What type of, are they going to experience, or you're going to, hopefully for them, you're setting up something that they experience? What is it?
You are going to feel that surge, that glorious run downhill. You're going to feel, like you say, when you're on the sea and you drop over the top and the nose drops down, you do feel that. Even if it's not a huge wave, you do feel the nose drop. You feel the load on the paddle decrease for the same speed, and you may feel the boat being twisted one way or another, left or right, depending on where you are on the wave. But you definitely feel that glorious, as Ivan said, like cycling a bike downhill. You have two choices. You can use that speed, that running downhill, and overtake the person, but you're wash hanging them for a reason, usually because they're quicker than you or you want to rest. So use the wave wisely. Either relax and bring your heart rate back down, or just wait for a tactical moment and then use the speed from that hill to overtake them.
Okay.
I think Scott is quite ambitious in that. I'm going to pull him up on that. Scott was pretty good at this as a skill, so perhaps he sees it very clearly. A lot of the kids you coach don't see it that clearly. They don't have that level of feel. The size of a wave another child's boat is creating at 4 miles an hour is nothing compared to the wave you're talking about on the ocean. So obviously the concept is there, you're going downhill, but to feel that, you have to have a very fine sense of feel. People who are good at it do have that fine sense of feel, but a majority don't. So I tend with my kids, Scott doesn't coach the kids in our club that are at a level where they can even begin to do this. So I get them, I'm kind of first coach in the line for this stuff. And I tend to do it visually to start with. So just lining your boat up with the other boat. If you're fortunate enough to have motorboats around, then you can position the kids so they can see that the front of their boat is lower in the water than normal. I'm not asking them to feel it, but they can see it. Position your boat where the nose is at its lowest. If you're behind another boat, I get them just to look at the other boat, and it's learning to steer with that other boat. I don't think a lot of them can feel anything at this stage, but you just get them to visually practice being in the right place at the right time. Then occasionally it does come together for them. You get a bigger kid or a slow adult come, and then they can begin to feel the waves. But initially, I tend to teach it visually.
Mm. And then when you talk about visually, Ivan, just to sort of dig into that a little bit, you know, I would imagine if I could keep up with you, you know, if you're paddling in front of me, you're creating a pattern behind your boat. Yeah. So I use that pattern as a visual cue.
Yeah.
If there's quite a few boats around, that
I guess that's way too complicated to teach.
So we're talking about almost
one-on-one.
One-on-one. Okay, right.
Well, you the other stuff happens sort of organically around, but you can't teach that at the beginner stage, I don't think. So one-on-one. So position your boat behind another boat. The boat in front of you creates that pattern you're talking about, and that what you see is a V shape coming off from the back of their boat. Provided you can keep your nose inside that V shape while you're within sort of a foot to 2 feet behind them, that's my start point. Steer your boat so your nose never goes outside of that V shape. And that's where I begin with them.
Okay, brilliant. Yeah, because I was thinking, Crumbs, you know, if you get lots of paddlers and you do see them on the water, then you know, it becomes more of a mess of a pattern. And in terms of what would you say is, you know, you say within the V, and this is just the way my head's working, is that gives me a left to right.
Yeah.
Aspect. What about distance to the other boat?
That comes down, if the wave is big enough, you have the visual of your nose being lower in the water. Bizarrely, you're all quite familiar with where your boat sits in the water. So when it does drop down, that is something you can notice. And then you come on to Scott's stuff about the feel. If you're good enough, you will move slightly further back, slightly further forward, see if it gets harder. So what I do with them, I tend to start them almost touching, which is the wrong place to be.
Yeah.
And then gradually have them drop back, drop back, drop back, drop back. They'll find it easier somewhere. I keep them dropping back, and then they find it harder somewhere. Now they're going up the hill. Mm-hmm. So it goes from hard to easy to hard. So they know there's a difference between the easy and the hard. Mm-hmm. But once they understand there's a difference that they're searching for, then there's something that they can actually look for and begin to feel for.
And how small is that sweet spot? Or is it, you know, a sweet spot that you've got to find, or is it quite a large area that you could actually?
It's a reasonably large area. And when I say large, we're talking 2 or 3 feet. But that also depends on the weight of the person that you're sitting on and the speed that they're going at. So in the beginning, it's a 2 or 3 foot sweet spot. And then when you get to the top level, that stretches out to sort of 5-6 feet, and depending on the depth of the water and going around corners and things like that, which is, you know, higher level still. But the nose to tail one is easy because they can mix, as Ivan was saying, visual and feel.
Okay, so someone's got the principles, the scaffolding, or whatever we want to call it. Yeah, lots of buzzwords around. Is someone understands the concept of wash hanging, and now it's around them. There may be some progressive exercises. What sort of things could you as a coach put in place, not just in your own sessions, but maybe something for them to think about when they're out paddling?
I always try to get people to, when they're wash hanging, slow their rate down. So their rate is matching the person that they're wash hanging as a minimum, and hopefully it's slightly slower than the person they're wash hanging. So they're being more efficient. They're not working as hard for the same speed. So my cue when I was a paddler and when I've been working with people is to make sure your rate slows down. And usually with the rate slowing down, the heart rate will slow down and then you can recover. So we set sessions with like 1 minute leads, and there'll be 4 people in a group. So you're sitting 4 different positions. So you can go along for 4 minutes doing, I'm going to say, 1 flat out lead and then 3 recoveries. And then you can go again and go again. So your work rate can be higher than you could do on your own, mm-hmm. because you're doing sort of active recovery and you're still moving and so on. So, I try and make the rate slower.
I have other stuff to add into that in terms of progressive exercises. You know, you've gone from
if we're talking marathon racing here, rather than just going for a paddle with your mate and using the wave to help you out a little bit, we're talking marathon racing here. So there's the 2 basic positions. You've got riding the wash on the tail, which we've already talked about.
Yeah.
And then your familiar position where you ride the wash just to the side of the other paddler and about half a length down. So they're your 2 basic. So what I try to do, once you've got them to feel on the back wash on the tail, when it feels easy and when it feels hard, then you can move them to the side. Again, initially visual, you're roughly half a length down. But now they have a concept of when it's easier and when it's harder, you can get them to position themselves in a place where it's at its easiest. And then from there, it's learning then to change from that side to the back and to the other side. Once you can change from the side wash to the tail wash to the other side wash, everything else, that's the building blocks of having 10 in the group, 20 in the group, 30 in the group. Those are the 3 things that repeat over and over. It's slightly more technical, but anyone who can move from the side to the tail to the side, that's your building blocks right there.
Okay. And Ivan, you know, in your introduction, you know, it, it felt like you were talking about, you know, using it wisely, and that's what enabled you to be highly successful. Can you use it as an acceleration to overtake?
Yeah, you can do, just like you see the cyclists, you know, they'll come up behind someone, or the Formula One, you know, they come up behind someone, then pull out and overtake. So you've got a run up. Our run up would obviously be going down the face of the wave. But then, of course, once you've gone down the face of a wave, the next phase is up the back of a wave. So the timing of all that is extremely difficult. But yes, if you want to overtake someone, you would gradually work your way back on the wave to the point where you're almost teetering on the top, then run all the way down it. And then how you get over the next wave is another puzzle in itself. You need to move out over the side of it rather than getting over it lengthways. So that's quite complicated to explain without pictures, I think. Mm-hmm. But yeah, absolutely, you can use it as an acceleration. But it rarely comes to that, because usually by the finish of a race, the leader is the one who's going to win anyway. You very rarely see last minute overtaking in marathon racing. You do see it. I call it on commentary, and every time I call it wrong. So yeah, it's kind of something I'm known for now, getting it wrong on the finish. But it's quite hard to overtake because of that uphill climb.
So can I add to that, Luke?
Yeah, please.
I think a visual way for people to think about it is, you know, you see the half pipes in the snowboarding and the skiing. If you're at the bottom of the hill, you haven't got much energy. If you're at the top of the hill, you've got all that acceleration down the hill, and they can get them up over to the other side where they do their flips in the air. Coming down the wave is the same. If you come from the top of the wave, you can accelerate down, and that will get you over the next hump. If you start at the bottom of the hill, all you're doing is accelerating uphill, and it's really, really hard. And that hill's moving away from you at the same time. So Ivan's point about riding up to the top of the hill, if you think about it as a snowboarder where you're just about to drop over the top of the lip, that's exactly where you want to sit, just on the top of the lip. So you were to do a little bit of work, you fall down the front and accelerate down.
In a minute, we're gonna move into a bit of around sort of setting up the coaching, sort of the coaching practice itself. So wash hanging is a race tactic, isn't it? In terms of, could you use that just to make your way up the field of paddlers?
It's not a race tactic, it's the race tactic in marathon racing. Yeah, it's, you see it in the cycling, you see the peloton. You need to hide as much as you can. In the easiest place you can, because over the 2 hours of your race, the more you've done under full power, the stronger you're going to be later on. So it is the meat, it's the bread and butter. You know, you can be fit as you like. It doesn't matter how fit you are. If someone's going essentially 3 seconds a minute easier than you, that's a lot easier. People have done the percentages. I think on the side, it's something like 15% easier. And if you get into the V at the back, it's 30%. You're saving 30%. Wow. It's huge. And it's not something you either choose to do or not. It's not a tool you decide whether you want it or not. You have to have it. It's not an option.
Great. So in terms of coaching, you know, we know within a lot of marathon clubs, there's less one-to-one coaching that goes on the water. There's quite a lot of group activity, isn't there? In terms of, you know, so how would you set up the use of wash hanging where other areas are going to be focused on? So like a multiple outcome session. So, you know, you want people to bear in mind wash hanging, but also their focus is on another particular area. How do you set that up? Because that's quite complex in itself, because from what I've seen, it's those sessions are just always moving.
I don't think you have to set it up at all. Once you've taught someone what it feels like going on a wave, if you've got a group going along, whether they're a marathon group or a sprint group on a sprint lake, if you're falling behind, you will find that wave and you will stay with the group. There are sprinters who've made their living out of sitting on waves. I got to a final, K2000 meter final, by riding a wave. There's a guy, I think he's Slovakian, Peter Geller. He's made his living for the last 10 years riding waves down a 1,000 meter course. Yeah, you're not directly next to the other boat, but the waves are still there, even if you're further away. So I don't think you need to set up a session. Once people have the skill set and a survival instinct, they will always find the wave, because if they don't find the wave, they get left behind. So I think it becomes quite organic in that way. If you want to set up a session for wash hanging, then you have to set scenarios
Okay.
Scenarios are quite hard in a group because the best person in the group is the best person in the group every week. And so they find everything easy. The slowest person finds everything hard. So you might have to dumb down the best person, give them a resistance band. All of a sudden, they're struggling for survival. They need to find the best wave. And it's necessity that accelerates your learning very, very quickly. People who think they're good and people who think they can win every effort and don't bother to learn, when the race comes, they come up extremely short, extremely quickly. They haven't got a plan B. It's the kids that have learned to survive. So you put people in survival type scenarios, and that's kind of how we teach.
Yeah, and that survival will then go into that race, that event, won't it? You know, they're using the same approach.
Yeah, people have different mindsets. I can only tell you how I thought. You're in a group. That can be a group of two. It can be a group of 10. My mind is always, where is the easiest place I can be? That's the only thought. I'm not thinking about winning, losing, a turn coming up, a portage coming up. My whole thought process is there somewhere easier than where I currently am? If the answer is yes, then rearrange things to get there. To sit somewhere where it's harder is, frankly, you're an idiot. But luckily, there are lots of idiots. So there's always someone prepared to do the hard work if you want to use them. So, and we love those people.
And what about yourself, Scott?
One of the things our coach did when we were kids, he'd have two groups reasonably equally matched, maybe like two quick ones in there and two weaker ones on one side of the river and two quick ones and two weaker ones on the other. And because you're competitive, you want to win, but your last person across the line was the one that counted. So that scenario is setting up so the quicker person just can't leave. They have to look after the group. They have to manage the group. So you learn from those sort of situations and you look after people, but you also know how hard you can go when people are struggling. And that transfers later on, as Ivan's saying, into those races where you can just see people are struggling. And are you going to look after them, or are you going to make their life a little bit harder here so that I don't have to work as hard later on? So, yeah, and those sorts of, you choose your best driver or your fastest leader, and then everyone has to stay with them and those sorts of things. So that, as Ivan said, you are experiencing hanging on for dear life.
You just said then about a part of learning there, isn't there? And there are certain aspects that you will see individuals struggling. So maybe it is scenarios, Ivan, you know, use that word in terms of, you know, setting up a practice. You are going to focus solely on wash hanging as a subject of a session. How do you create feedback loops? And you know, one is the intrinsic feedback loop that people are feeling, and the other one is actual your interjection as a coach for development development opportunities. You know, how do you set that up?
Always, that's situationally dependent. So it depends how many people you've got to practice your wash hanging. If you've only got two people, then you can only practice certain things. If you've got four, you can practice more, and then you can get into the discomfort of more than four. As soon as you get more than four, discomfort arises in those groups. So if you're tall, you know, you're generally working with the slowest person in the group, trying to protect them from the other people in the group. So if you can put them in a position where they have a realization that, hang on a minute, I'm going along with the big guns here, and I've still got capacity to think, I've still got capacity to change speed, that's a very positive feel for someone. You're going along with people who are puffing and blowing that you can't normally keep up with. Nobody doesn't notice that. And that's the real, like, that's your eureka moment. Do you see that you just kept up with, you know, Big Johnny? And that's, as much as you talk to them about feel of the wave, there's so much going on often that to separate their thought process out from what they're seeing to what they're feeling to how they feel, as in fatigue and stuff like that, there's so much going on that it's quite hard to isolate a feeling or a thought process. So it's just to ask them, you know, were you tired at the end of that? Often they'll say, not really. I say, well, have a look over your shoulder at your mate here, who's red in the face, puffing out of both ends. What, how do you think he looks like he feels? Like, oh, he looks tired. And it's just that realization that there is this skill you can use that is a lifesaver. And that's literally what it is for you. In that race, in that situation, there's a tool you can always go back to. I'm feeling rubbish here. I'm tired. I'm out of breath. Yeah, we've all been in a situation where you think, hang on a minute, I'm on a limited lifespan here. If I carry on like this, it's only ending one way. Look for the best tool you've got, and that's finding a safe place in that group. And that might mean, yeah, you're changing the shape of the group. That's complex stuff, realizing how you can change the shape of a wash hanging group. But that's the toolkit you're gradually building. First, you have to find out what a wave is. Then you have to find out how to swap from one wave to another. Then you have to learn what Scott's just told you about, reading the body language of the other people. And then learning how, if I need that shape to change, what do I need to do to instigate that change so that it suits me? And that's always your thought process. What suits me? It's a very selfish thought process, but that's sport generally, right? So I don't know, in terms of feedback loops, you're just putting the kids in positions where it's impossible for them to not feel something good. And then you get them to tell you that they felt it, understand why it was that they felt it, and then repeat and repeat and repeat. And sometimes that's putting them in a worse place. So they go, that's how it could have felt, mate. That if you were sat on that wave, that's how hard the same effort, the same speed would have been in that place. Or we can go in this place. You could do that with a heart rate monitor if you're one of those technical people who like the data and the feedback. But I prefer feel rather than data on that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Scott, you got any thoughts on that particular area?
Yeah, well, as a coach, one of the most exciting things you see is when one of your kids stays with a group that they have no right to be with, and they stay there legitimately, and they finish in that group that is something like 15 seconds quicker than them, and they sit there and they stay there. And once one person does it, the others realize, oh, that's possible. And then the confidence grows. Don't want to name names, but Ivan knows who I'm talking about. We have one lady, one effort every week. She now does this effort in the middle group, and she's a young girl. She's going with people that are 15 seconds quicker than her, you know, regularly, and she's just finding those big hills. That's really rewarding as a coach, until of course she knocks you off the wash. But once you've seen someone of your speed and your ability do it, you know it is possible. And then when you do it, you know it's possible. And then you repeat. And I think you have to set up a culture with a group that allows that as well. Some people are quite aggressive and they won't allow people to join in their groups. You see that at various different clubs, usually with men of a certain age who are on the way down the hill rather than the kids that are on the way up. But it is vital skill that those people with more experience and are used to.
Yeah, listening to Scott on that, I think we've actually missed out one of the stages that you go through automatically without really knowing it. When we do those sort of group races where everybody's involved, the coaches will go and herd one of the kids, like sheepdogs, and they're not expecting the kid to put themselves in the right position, but the coaches will gather themselves around a child and lead them into it. So they haven't had a choice in the matter. You've put them exactly where they need to be, which is generally quite a slow part of an effort. And then that group will speed up and up and up and go right past everybody, and the child will come with them, because you've got three fat coaches and a midget kid sat on the wave of three fat coaches. And it's virtually impossible not to do well in that situation. Mm-hmm. So I think we're very lucky, and certainly in our club, we've got quite a few very savvy wave riders, but and who are equally quite sensitive to the kids, so the kids get quite a lot out of that.
Yeah, so almost you use the word shepherding, don't you, in terms of sheepdog and getting them into position. There's probably a couple of aspects in there just for them to understand that actually this is how you get into that position.
Yeah,
but also giving them the confidence to move into that position, isn't it? I think it's quite interesting when you're young and paddling with older, people that are older, is just to have the confidence to actually just get in there.
I think that's a very good point, actually, because one of the favourite waves you ever want to be on, they call it a V-wash, so you're on the tail of the leader who's got a boat either side and you're tucked in, finishing off that diamond shape, if you like. It feels initially very restrictive in there. You don't feel like you've got a lot of space to move around. You feel a bit constrained. It also looks like it should be rough water in there. It turns out it isn't, but there's a lot of splash. There's a lot of visual roughness that isn't actually real in terms of the water itself. So it's quite an intimidating place to be. And when you meet people who haven't had the luxury of bigger groups, often they don't like being in that wave, even though it's the best of the best, because they just don't feel that comfort. So yeah, you're dead right about giving them the confidence to go and do that.
Something I failed to ask right at the beginning, Ivan, is I'm asking Ivan, clear that Ivan works with the new paddlers that come in, so you've obviously got a thriving club down there, is, you know, you say about wash hanging being almost the most important aspect. At what stage do you actually introduce it then? You know, someone's turned up for the first time, you know, you've got a group of kids that have joined the club, they're, you know, really enthusiastic to get onto the water. What is the triggers for you to go, now it's the time to introduce this?
I think even Scott starts the real beginners, but they're not at a skill level where they could do this stuff. So I probably get them at that first level where they can actually do it. But the reality is Scott starts them before that, because he will have them going paddling side by side, not on the wave, but just side by side. He'll have them practicing nose to tail, just following each other. So the earlier you start the concept of being able to position your boat where you want to position it, the better. It's really simple stuff. Three people paddling side by side without crashing is at Scott's level, not Scott's personal level, it's Scott's coaching, is a very difficult thing, because what they do, they paddle along looking at each other. And as soon as you look at something, you go towards it and they end up in a pile. So it's learning to sort of almost feel the boat's going in the same direction at the same time. And that will be right in the, I don't know, week two, week three, straight away. Scott will have them for, I know, let's pick up 3 months, 4 months, yeah. Ideally, the ones that are actually going to go and do something in sport. And then I get them from there. And then we start to do the nose to tail with a purpose, where you're trying to actually feel a position. It becomes more and more important that your nose doesn't go outside that V we talked about at the very early stage of this podcast. And you start to fine tune it and do it as a drill rather than a playtime. Mm-hmm. So yeah, right from the start, because it's certainly a marathon race, and it's a massive skill.
Yeah. And it almost feels, you know, what you were just explaining there, Ivan, is, you know, right at the very beginning, there's an understanding there are building blocks within, you know, Scott's particular session that they need to have before they move into your group.
Yeah, if you pass them up too early, it's a right royal pain in the ass, because they haven't got the basics to do what we're trying to do now. Yeah. So he knows when they can come, and yeah, that's and being able to paddle side by side or nose to tail is one of those prerequisites, basically.
And that, you know, and I know our conversations are out and wash hanging today, but, you know, that's something that's really fundamental within any club, isn't it? About, you know, what sort of sessions and what sort of topics are going to be covered, and what level do people need to be at, or ability need to be at, to move into the next session. I think, you know, otherwise it does create issues, doesn't it, for the coach and for the participant, for the paddler.
It's crucial, actually, because you always have, and Scott can probably think of a couple of kids at our club, a big athletic kid who speed-wise belongs further up the ladder. But because they got fast too quickly, they haven't had time to learn the skills at each group. So initially they progress through the club very, very quickly, but then they end up where people are the same speed as them, who've now got a better skill set, and that halts their progression for a very, very long time before they can move on again, which is quite depressing for them, because they've had this massive acceleration through the club at the start. Of course, their parents think they're the greatest thing ever. They think they're the greatest thing ever, but they haven't gone through the stages. They haven't put all the building blocks in place, and they stall quite badly after that. So yeah, sometimes I can think of one kid I've got in my group at the moment who's too fast, but there's no way he's going up to the next group, because it won't go well for him once he. I don't know if that's a general thing that all clubs can adapt, or whether you just adapt that between yourselves because you know what each one's coaching at each level. it's kind of grows organically. It's not written down, is it, Scott?
No.
I wouldn't have thought it's written down in any particular club, isn't it? And it's almost done on the coaching participant or paddler just needs to know it's when it's right to move, etc., isn't it? And
yeah, but it is also equally very hard to explain to a kid who's given everyone else in their group a whooping, and there's the good kids are in the group above. He wants to go and race the good kids. It's very hard on them to say, actually, no, mate, you're not going up yet. Yeah, I'll pick a time. Yeah. And some of them, yeah, and I can understand why, they start to feel like you're deliberately holding them down. And you do all of it for the best, with the best intent, and because you've seen it before. But it is, they're hard decisions to make sometimes.
They've got to be ready for the challenge as well. You know, that sometimes when they start winning quite easily, then going into the group where they're going to be the slowest, they're not necessarily emotionally ready for it. Because as yeah. Ivan said, you know, they've been at the club for 3 months, they've gone through two groups, and then suddenly they just get beaten every effort, every session, every day, every week. So, you know, you have to look after them emotionally as well, because they are there for fun.
Yeah. And you know, for that to happen to someone, and that acceptance and understand, you've got to be quite robust, haven't you? And I think we all have those particular wrestles. And I think, you know, clubs definitely within moving those athletes, those paddlers through to next groups is difficult. I've really enjoyed this, you know, chatting to you both. And I think an insight into your approaches to what wash hanging is, the importance of it and how you go about coaching, I think it's been great. And I hope the listeners have enjoyed it as well, and really appreciate your time. I know you're both busy. You've just come back from the club for a coaching session this morning and then jumped onto this call. So very much appreciated. And thanks very much for your time. And don't be surprised I don't call you up and ask you to do another podcast. Yeah. So thank you very much.
Cheers. Thanks, Lee. Cheers, Scott.
Cheers, Ivan.
Thanks for listening. We hope you'll join us for the next episode. Remember to review, rate, and subscribe. Bye for now.